And our guest to discuss today for the full hour will be Commander John T. Kuhn, U.S. Navy retired, Ph.D., and author of the Naval Institute Press book, Agents of Innovation. And he's also a co-author of a book by Dennis Giangreco, Eyewitness Pacific Theater. Dr. Kuhn, he's a former EP3 and ES3 naval aviator who completed cruises on four different aircraft carriers. He flew reconnaissance missions during the last decade of the Cold War, also the First Gulf War in the Balkans, excuse me. Commander Kuhn has served on the faculty of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College since July of 2000. He retired from the Naval Service in 2004, and he got his Ph.D. in history from Kansas State University back in 2007. John, welcome to MidRaps.
Hey, thanks to be here.
Hey, and thanks for taking time this Sunday to join us. And just to kind of establish a baseline for everybody, if you could please describe for the listener what the General Board was and why it came into existence.
Well, that's a good question, Sal. The General Board was the culmination of a long effort by the Officer Corps of the United States Navy during the 19th century to come up with a planning staff for war. The Navy after, believe it or not, after the War of 1812, which we're going to celebrate the 100th year anniversary of next year, the Navy officers went to Congress, and they tried to get a board established. What they got established was the Board of Navy Commissioners, but they didn't get what they wanted. They wanted an operational planning staff composed of post captains. What they got was a bunch of guys who were admin guys. Civilians retained operational control of the fleet in their hands. And in 1842, this system of the Navy Board of Commissioners was turned into something that a lot of us know about, the bureaus. So five Navy bureaus, and it was still all administrative functions. Well, this all kind of goes on and on through the 19th century. The Navy never really gets what it wants, and most operational control remains in civilian hands. And as the Navy and the nation are getting towards the end of the 19th century, there were some very progressive-minded officers in the Navy, Henry Luce, A.T. Mahan, Henry Taylor, guys like that, and they really wanted an operational planning staff. And their model, believe it or not, was the German General Staff. They were all familiar with the German General Staff. They knew of the relationship of a German General Staff to professional military education, that basically the Germans had a staff college, a war college, the Kriegsakademie, that created planners. And they said, you know, maybe we can't get this planning staff, but what we'll do is we'll get a Naval War College. So what they did is they hid the planning function inside the Naval War College. And the Naval War College not only educated naval officers, but it also did war plans. Not very well known outside the Navy and the Navy historical community that this, in fact, was what the Navy War College was doing. Then came the Spanish-American War, and the conduct of that war resulted in the creation of a strategy board, which included the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Teddy Roosevelt. It also included Captain Mahan, who by this time was extremely famous. Now Roosevelt went off to fight in the war, but Mahan stayed around, and this Navy Strategy Board provided John D. Long, the Secretary of the Navy, with advice on how to do the war. And after the war was over, one of the first things that was done was they said, well, you know, this worked out pretty well, but it was ad hoc. We want a long-term thing. So General Order 544 was signed by John D. Long. And I've got the date right here. I've got a manuscript of my thing here. Was signed in 1900 by John D. Long, establishing a General Board of the Navy. And the purpose was really simple, which was it would provide the Secretary of the Navy advice. And now that sounds pretty tame, but what it meant was that the Navy finally had a standing staff, a board of officers. We use the term board. It's very American, you know. Chairman of the board of directors, you know, not general staff, so you kind of avoid the militarism piece. And so we established this general board, and what it really was a general staff to plan for war, to do war plans. The general board is the outfit that originally wrote War Plan Orange, and they did all the war planning during the period up until the establishment of the Chief of Naval Operations. It didn't get as far as the people who wanted the reforms wanted it to go, Mahan and Henry Taylor and some of these other guys. But eventually they got what they wanted, but they already had this general board. It included the Admiral of the Fleet, Admiral Dewey, the hero of Manila Bay, and then it changed its character over time. But initially it was a pretty limited number of guys. But just prior to World War I and the establishment of the Chief of Naval Operations, it had gone into sections, and you had an aide for operations and an aide for logistics and everything. So it was really starting to look like a general staff when the Chief of Naval Operations was created. Some people identify the creation of the CNO OPNAV in legislation in 1915 and 1916 as the end of the General Board's general staff function and planning function. And of course, my book argues completely the opposite. The General Board remains sort of the overarching great general staff, except they're not doing detailed planning. They're doing sort of they called themselves the balance wheel. And anybody who's ever been in mechanical engineering knows they're a governing function. They work with the bureaus, they work with OPNAV, they work with the Naval War College, they work with the fleet to make sure that the war plans, the design of the fleet, and the budgets, and the advice that the Secretary of Navy is using to craft grand strategy at the highest levels are all synchronized. And so their function becomes more and more of a strategic function and less of an operational function. That's a big mouthful. I can go into more details if you'd like, but that's sort of the quick and dirty from A to Z.
Well, let's, as Larry Munson, the legendary voice of the Georgia Bulldogs, used to say, let's get the picture. We're talking now. It's after World War I. We've got this general board, and the country's undergoing some changes. The Navy's undergoing some changes. What's the general board up to?
Well, the general board is where that the Secretary of Navy goes for big policy decisions, the major policy decisions. And after World War I, it's not well known, but World War I ends, and the three major naval powers are Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, and they are in a naval arms race. Now, this is ironic because many people have identified the start of the Great War as this ruinous arms race that had already been taking place between France, Great Britain, Germany, and for a little while Russia, but Russia got knocked out in 1905 by the Japanese. But so you've got the victors of the Great War, the Western powers and their westernized ally in the Pacific, Japan, who are engaged in a naval arms race, and the Secretary of the Navy goes to the General Board and says, okay, what should we do? What should our policy be? How should we do things? Now, that's not the only voice that's arguing for policy. There's also the voice of what I call the anti-war crowd, Herbert Hoover, Henry Ford, Andrew Carnegie, this peace crowd that says, no, we need to abolish navies. Navies are one of the reasons we had this war. But the Secretary of the Navy goes to the General Board and says, well, what's your solution? During the war, the board's solution was something called a Navy second to none. In other words, they said, well, in order for us to be able to do the things that we want to do in the world where we won't have the Germans telling us what to do and we won't have the British telling us what to do, we need to have a fleet as big as anybody else's fleet. So they had the second to none Navy, and that was the Navy Act of 1916, which was on track to create the largest naval force known to man. And Great Britain and Japan were horrified that the United States Navy had passed this act and was actually building these ships, because there was no way Japan, with a very limited fiscal basis for her economy, or Britain, now in hock to Wall Street, could afford to build these navies to keep up with this U.S. Navy second to none Navy. So, and the U.S. knew this, so they got all these opinions, and one of the opinions was the board's. Well, the board had the conservative opinion. The board said, let's fortify Guam, build up our bases in the Philippines, and continue building until the other powers show us that they're serious about cutting back on their building programs and show the same desire. This is the language that they use, show the same desire for Pacific intentions that we have in the United States. We always, you know, think of ourselves as being the Pacific people and everybody else is not being. Well, you've got Japan, an up-and-comer, and then you've got Britain, who's not quite ready to abandon her role as the imperial policeman of the world, even though the baton has passed during World War One. But she still hasn't recognized it. It always takes a while to catch up. So that leads to the Washington Naval Conference, because there's a naval arms race. There's a war scare with Japan in 1920 and 21. There's horrible racist legislation being passed in California that's aggravating the Japanese. And the Japanese actually at this point in time probably have the most liberal and enlightened government that they will have between about 1860 and 1945. That right now is the period of what they call Taisho democracy. And so the Japanese are actually open to dealing squarely and fairly with the Americans and the British. So you have the three victors gathering together at Washington. And but the board says, the board's viewpoint is to go in with the hard line and say, well, you prove to us that you're Pacific. So that's their plan, and it all revolves around fortifying Guam.
The general board in its internal discussions and the Navy strategy and directions it wanted the Navy to go and working with Congress, how did it interact with its Army counterpart? And did you see the type of open inter-service rivalry and discussion of where funds should go like we saw in the early 50s with the revolt of the admirals?
Well, there was a bit of a revolt of the admirals already. The general board was very unhappy with the Washington Conference, and Henry Cabot Lodge ran the treaty through Congress without any hearings. And so the general board felt that their advice had been ignored. But I don't make a big deal out of that in the book. I mention it. But you sort of get a revolt of the admirals in 1930 by the general board. But let me go back to your fundamental question, which is Army-Navy relationships. And remember, the Army is gearing down after the war, too. In fact, the Army takes humongous cuts. And this is one reason the whole deal with Billy Mitchell comes up, because you've got this whole air power thing going on as well, where the air power guys are saying, we don't need a Navy. We don't need much of an Army because we can do it all with airplanes. They believe the technology has made everything obsolete. And I did a paper a couple years ago. It's supposed to be published this year in an anthology by Naval War College on the whole issue with the Ost-Friesland and Mitchell and Army-Navy relationships. But generally speaking, the relationship was pretty good. I mean, it was cordial between what I would call the controlling faction in the U.S. Army, that is the officers who really kind of were gathered around Black Jack Pershing. And you know, eventually the Army has to discipline the air power guys, and they court-martial Mitchell. And again, Mitchell had it coming. He was a loudmouth, and he made excessive claims. The general board held hearings, and they brought Mitchell before the general board. And the Admiral Badger and Admiral Winterhalter and Admiral Rogers were all very, very even-handed with Mitchell, but Mitchell was very, very aggressive, almost rude. At one point, though, they actually kind of got him talking a little bit more relaxed. He was less adversarial, and he said some pretty intelligent things, but he also said, hey, we can try some stuff out in Chesapeake Bay, referring to the eventual tests against the Ost-Friesland. So sometimes people get confused, and the Army and the Navy were at war, and they weren't at war. They were all trying to figure out, what do we do after the war is over? What really happened is the civilians controlled everything. They controlled the debate, and we can talk a little bit more about that in a second. But the general board was the contributing organization to the Army-Navy joint board. So your question leads to an even more interesting concept, which is we need more on the joint board, on the Army-Navy joint board. And I've been really interested in that. I've been finding out all kinds of fascinating things and researching the general board. And actually, the general board as a body retained membership on the joint board. It said so right in legislation. The Navy membership and the Army-Navy joint board shall consist of the general board, of the Navy, of the members of the General Board of Navy. Now, did all of these guys, usually around 11 or 12 of them, sometimes as few as 7 or 8 of them, did all of them go to the joint board meetings? No, I'm starting to figure out that they had sections inside the General Board, and I believe it was one of those sections that was sort of like the guys that always had. So the relationship was there. There was an opportunity, and there's been a lot of writing going back and forth because, you know, you'll see the Navy say one thing as the General Board, and then the Joint Board will say something that contradicts something that the General Board said, and people go, well, you know, that goes to show you that the General Board wasn't in step or the Joint Board wasn't in step or both boards were out to lunch when it came to defense of the United States. And actually, what it shows you is at a higher strategic level, at the joint board level, there was compromise. People were willing to say, well, this is a Navy position, but now here's the joint position. But more work needs to be done on the joint board because it was a fascinating organization, much less formal, a little bit more ad hoc than the general board was, but a standing board as well, so kind of a joint strategic staff, general staff, if you will. This brings me to one of my major points I make with my students here, which is, you know, we have this joint board, we have a Secretary of the Navy, a Secretary for War, we have the general board, and this is such a horrible system that we need to completely, well, I'm not going to use the Navy word for it. You know what that one is, blank can. We need to get rid of, we need to crap can this entire structure that we have because it did such a horrible job in World War II, and that's why we lost World War II is because the Joint Board, the General Board, and the Cabinet, as it was structured in the interwar period, was such a fiasco. And the students all kind of give me a cross-eyed look, and they go, well, we didn't lose World War II. And then I hop on them, and I go, that's the point. We did not lose World War II. This is a pretty good system. But that gets me off on a whole tangent, and I'll stop talking at this point.
Yeah, don't get me excited about Goldwater Nichols, or you won't shut me up either.
This is the National Defense Act of 1947. And I make an argument about that, that, you know, the unification, which I think the United States wisely said, no, we're not ready for it right now. In 1926, the Morrow Board, after World War II, because pretty much of the air power crowd, we said, now we're ready for unification. And unification may have been the way to go for the Cold War. Because of these nuclear weapons, you really needed unity of command. You really needed forces in the driver's seat. But, you know, with the Cold War over, I'm not convinced that that system is useful for us anymore in a post-Cold War multipolar world like we live in. The General Board, the Joint Board, a Secretary of the Navy who's in the Cabinet and not working for a Secretary of Defense, a Secretary of the Army, a Secretary of the Air Force, get rid of SecDef, you know. Maybe that system was a good system. It worked for us all the way to 1947, and then we shit-canned it. Oop, excuse me, I'm sorry. I apologize to your listeners.
Oh, that's okay. We've heard worse.
Yes, some of them may have used that word themselves at some point. All right, so let me get back to the. Am I still here?
You're here.
Yes.
Okay. All right. I can never tell what the way my system works. We're looking at the end of World War One. We've got these peacenik President Hoover, and they're trying to disarm the United States, and they've gone to this Washington conference. And among the things they've agreed to, and that you pick out as a key point, is the fortress provision of the agreement they reached. Can you describe what that is and kind of go off from there, as you do in your book, about why that's so important to the innovation and what happened to the United States Navy?
Well, the first thing I want to mention is the peaceniks. They're not all bad. In fact, the hero at the Washington conference is Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes. He ran against Wilson in 1916, and it's a shame he didn't win. I felt that way. I still will feel that way. A great statesman. He really handed a fait accompli to the Japanese and the British. He said, listen, we'll scrap a million tons of battleships, okay? And we'll save money. You save money. All you got to do is agree that we get to be the equivalent of Great Britain, and you Japanese will accept 60% of the number of battleships that we have. And that was what the deal was. Now, it shocked everybody. It was really a coup. So these peaceniks actually saved us a lot of money, and they really did pull off what I would call a diplomatic Pearl Harbor at Washington by offering to scrap almost twice as much tonnage as anybody else, and in some cases as much tonnage as the next two combined, not the British, of course. The United States really put everybody in a bad spot. Well, a Japanese chief delegate was a guy named Admiral Kato Tamasaburo. He was chief of staff to Admiral Togo at the Battle of Tsushima. Very enlightened man, would later become Prime Minister of Japan and tragically die early. Too bad that he did die, because he believed the United States and Japan could have this Pacific partnership. So if he were alive today, he would say, ah, my vision has come true. So, but he was willing to accept the 60% ratio, but this caused a huge problem in Japan, particularly inside the Japanese Navy. He had a subordinate named Admiral Kato Kanji, and Kato Kanji was a firebrand from the Imperial Naval General Staff. And he said, we can't accept an inferior position to the United States, even though if Japan could not keep up in a naval arms race with the United States. The elder Kato, Baron Kato Tamasaburo, understood that. He knew, hey, if we get into an arms race with the United States, we'll lose, and the United States will fortify in the Pacific, and it's really not in our best interest or their best interest, and it's just going to cost us all this money. I mean, we don't have the money. We just fought a war, you know, and although Japan didn't do much, she did escort convoys in the Mediterranean with destroyers, and she helped out, so she had war debts too. So they agree to this, but the way that Baron Kato got the United States diplomats and a couple of their admirals, including later Admiral William V.Z. Pratt, to agree to this was to say, listen, we'll accept the United States having 100% and us only having 60%, which meant the United States would have around 500,000 tons of battleships and the Japanese would only have 300,000 tons. We'll accept that if you agree not to fortify your bases in the Western Pacific. You haven't fortified them to date, and all we're asking for you to do is just keep the status quo in place. Now, what he knew that would do is give Japan local command of the sea and superiority due to logistics in the Far East. He was basically setting the Japanese up so that if they ever did go to war with the American fleet in the Western Pacific, the American fleet would have this horrible logistics challenge to overcome because she didn't have improved bases, dry docks, airfields, stocks, coastal guns, and everything in Guam and in the Philippines. And the United States said, you know what, it's worth it to save all this money and to maintain that superiority in battleships. And also, they threw in the carriers, so we also had a 10-6 ratio in carriers. So the United States would also have that advantage, that 40% advantage in carriers. So we agreed. Now, in order for this to work, the United States was going to have to build every ton she was allowed under the tree. Fortunately for everybody, there was a battleship building holiday, so nobody could build any battleships for 10 years, and after London in 1930, it would extend it another 5 years. So battleship tonnage was frozen, but you could build cruisers and carriers and submarines and destroyers and floating dry docks and sump tenders, so you could build everything else. And this system was a pretty good system for the United States if the United States built during the interwar. But what it meant was the United States was going to have to build a seagoing fleet that would maintain itself, basically sort of sea basing. Now, at first, the Navy didn't see it that way. It just seemed like too big of a problem because you had to get all this money to build these gigantic ships. The clause became known as the Fortification Clause. It was Article 19 of the treaty, and it was enforced for the length of the treaty, and then in London it would be enforced again for about another 6 years. I argue in the book that the United States never really violated that treaty up until about 1940. Well, it wasn't until about 1940 that the United States didn't really violate the treaty because it had lapsed, but the United States pretty much didn't fortify or improve its possessions in the Pacific until about 1940 after the war started. And even then, Guam was never fortified, even though the General Board said, we really need to fortify it, we really need to fortify it. So what this did was this drove ship design. It drove how big a ship you were going to build. So the United States realized, you know, if we're going to build cruisers, we're going to have to build the biggest cruisers possible. If we're going to build submarines, we have to build long-range submarines. If we're going to build destroyers, they've got to be long-range. You know, everything has got to be long range. We've got to convert to diesel fuel and diesel fuel marine. We've got to take our coal burners and go to oil burners. So we need to modernize the inner of the ship. So all of this, the treaty drove design. And the Navy also realized, well, if we can't build dry docks, we'll have to build floating dry docks. And they even talked about crazy things like submersible fuel tenders to fuel the shorter-range S-class submarines until they could get their bigger submarines out. And so this created an environment useful for innovation, and as it turned out, with the budget constraints that occurred, it really made the Navy look at some innovative programs that it probably wouldn't have looked at. And when I say the Navy, I mean the General Board. The General Board controlled everything when it came to fleet design. They really did. From 1919 to 1940, the General Board was really in the driver's seat when it came to designing ships. How many destroyers are we going to have? 300. The General Board made decisions like that. How many submarines do we need? No, we need 120, you know, cruiser submarines. And the General Board were the guys making these decisions, and they lined them up with the war plans. And they would take a look at War Plan Orange, for example, and go, well, this is what we need for War Plan Orange. We need to be able to service 736 ships on M plus 120, you know, in our fleet bases in the Pacific in order to make the war plan work. Very, very fascinating study of how the Navy really thought through the whole problem.
I think, you know, one of the second and third order effects that you outlined perfectly of the treaty limitations was it forced the Navy to really appreciate and think about the tyranny of distance that is the Pacific theater. And if you move that up to 2011, you know, the Earth hasn't shrunk. Technology has changed a little bit, but what hasn't changed are the challenges it takes to project power across the Pacific. And a worry many people have had is in the intervening few decades, we've become kind of spoiled and forgetful with our bases in Japan, our access to other ports in the West Pacific. We haven't fully appreciated what it might mean if those disappeared tomorrow. And you look at what the present Chief of Naval Operations calls the cornerstone of the fleet, the LCS, an incredibly short-ranged and unsupportable platform. Have we really forgotten the requirements of power projection over a long distance? And is there any appreciation? There's been some discussions of sea basing, but it always seems to just be up on the PowerPoint. How close are we to reappreciating what we, in effect, learned by accident after the treaties?
Well, I think the General Board would be very comfortable with the challenges facing the United States today, because the situation that's on our horizon is exactly the situation they faced at the end of World War I. I mean, here was a mostly land-focused war, although there had been this asymmetric terrorist weapon at sea, the submarine, that had thrown a loop to everybody. But they knew that there were going to be cuts. They knew the money was going to, you know, the money was going to get turned off. And it did. I mean, it got turned off in a big way, a lot more than they expected, to be honest. And I argue that in some sense that kind of helped things out a little bit, although it was dangerous. If we'd have gone to war in 1930, we would have been woefully unprepared. Now, we weren't so unprepared in 1940 and 1941. That's one of the arguments in the book. But I think the General Board would recognize that. And the reason is because the General Board was a strategic organization. They really thought about strategy. I've read so much of their stuff, and I see the same approach that we see when we teach the students here about strategy, which is strategy is all about matching your ends, your policy ends, your objectives, the objectives of your grand strategy to your end, to your ways and your means, you know, your planning and your resources. Whether your resources, you know, are a fleet or an army or the industrial base or the shipping lanes and how the shipping lanes work and all that. And I think the reason we've forgotten is we've gotten this myopia because we've been in these, we've been doing power projection for so long now we kind of forgot that the tyranny, as you say, of geography. It's not a tyranny, it's a blessing. Mahan was wonderful in pointing this out for his day. It's one of the reasons I kind of try to steer people back to Mahan. He pointed out, you know, the tyranny of geography is also the blessing of geography. The United States is a maritime island. We're a continental island astride all the trade routes of the world, and we essentially are providing sort of like the immune system for the circulatory system of the world economy. That is this American-led consortium of navies that tries to keep the peace on the high seas. And this peace has been in place on the high seas now since 1945. It was challenged a bit during the Cold War, but we never had a collapse and an outright air. There was the potential for war, and I've talked about that in a couple articles here and there. But I think the general board would recognize that. So my issue is that Americans don't understand grand strategy anymore. I wrote an article for Military Review last year called Talking Grand Strategy. And I say, you know what, if you think about what the grand strategy of the United States is, then it makes and then you figure out what those ends are and what do we want. We want the commerce of the world to flow freely across the oceans, including our own, right? We don't want anybody to make us pay tribute to to pirates in Tripoli or to pirates in the Strait of Malacca or to some rogue nation in the Strait of Hormuz, or somebody all of a sudden says, well, we've got an economic security zone and you can't trade through there, you know. And so, you know, and that's always been that it's taken for granted now because it's this Pax Americana has been in place for so long at sea that people kind of take it for granted and they don't realize what's needed. And so what does the Navy do? Well, the Navy fights in close to the shore and projects power into Asia and Europe. And, you know, that's kind of what I did in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and what I did in Bosnia when I was in the Adriatic. And it's what we've seen the Navy doing for Iraq and Afghanistan. You know what? That's gravy. That's not what the Navy's for. The Navy is to protect the United States, and it's to protect our commerce, and it is to support the Army when the Army and the Marine Corps and the Air Force get involved in fighting our wars. And that's what the Navy's goal is, okay? It's a defensive goal. Navies are primarily defensive instruments of national power. They're there to defend trade. They're there to defend commerce. And they're there to defend mostly economic interests related to the seas. And those are only going to increase because most of the trade in the world goes by sea. It's only increasing. People live near the sea. People are moving towards the sea. And so the whole idea that we're going to move most international commerce via air or via land or via landways is ridiculous. Two-thirds of the earth is covered with this global commons. You guys have heard the CNO and Mullins and Clark and all the other guys talk about it, and it really is true. And so we need to design ships to protect our interests on the global commons. That's the starting point. Then you have to start to get into it. But if you start by designing a ship for a narrow operational purpose of fighting close in the littoral somewhere, well, which littoral are we talking about here? If we're talking about the Strait of Hormuz, then I'm fine with that. Then let's design what we need to design to maintain the viability and the navigability of the Strait of Hormuz for everybody and ourselves, if that's what we're doing. If that's not what we're doing, then we need to take a step back and go, okay, maybe that wasn't the right approach. Everybody criticizes the Navy today, saying, well, the Navy wants these big aircraft carriers and marine freighters and gator freighters and the Tarawa and the Bonhomme Richard and all these ships, you know, to fight another blue water peer competitor. Well, we don't have one of those right now. We really don't. We might. We could. So I think we need to be prepared. I'm sort of a mind of Jerry Hendricks. I'm kind of in his camp on this. And then CNA, the Center of Naval Analysis, recently did this tipping point thing where they talk about these kind of six futures of the United States Navy. And the one that we seem to be executing is the one that they recommend against, which is status quo. They say if we keep trying to do what we're doing with the Navy and our naval force structure, we're going to decline maybe gracefully, maybe not so gracefully, into being a second-class maritime power. Personally, I think that's almost impossible. If we're not a maritime power, then the United States is going to become a failed state. That's my own view. So personally, I don't think that's an option. But that seems to be the option that we're doing right now. Well, if we had a general board, if we had some clear strategic, grand strategic thinking in the United States, and I think we do in some spots here and there, and you've got some guys who understand these things. Admiral Stavridis comes to mind. Admiral Harvey comes to mind. But if we don't do it, you know, there are other options, and I like the option that we did between the wars. I like the idea that we, and I talk about this in an article I called "Is Mahan Dead?" You know, the idea of okay, we've got a Pacific structure and a forward-based structure in the Pacific. We're really a Pacific Asian-centric nation now. Maybe we go to one forward deployed fleet and the rest of it is really back here at home plate. And it sorties out, but we don't have the major sort of levels of effort like we do now. We're going to stand down from Afghanistan and Iraq.
John, you there? Eagle One, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, looks like we lost John. Hopefully he had a full battery. John, are you still there? Okay, let's cycle here. John, are you here? He was just getting on a roll. Well, I'll tell you what. let's recycle circuit breakers here. Raytheon reset, and let's see what we have here.
Well, while you're doing that,
why don't you fill the white space for us?
Yeah, let me fill some white space with a plug for the Valor IT project, which is the fundraising going on now until the 14th of July. As some of you may know, it's an effort through Soldier Angels to provide voice-activated laptops and some other electronic equipment for our troops who've lost arms or hands or their eyes. And gives them access to the world that we all know and love with the internet and voice and email and all that stuff. So I know that all the Navy bloggers have websites up and links to the Valor IT, and I ask that you please be generous in your donations. The goal this year is 100,000, and I think last time I checked we were around 20-something thousand. So we have a way to go, but please make a contribution. And on the chat room, if you can see it, Tom is Curian has listed the address. But again, you can go to my website at Eagle Speak or at Commander Salamander, and you can link up to these things. I guess Sal is trying to see if the state of Kansas has disappeared from the map, or it's just John's phone that died. So we'll find out here in a second. You can get, by the way, the book that John Kuhn is talking about is called Agents of Innovation. It's from the U.S. Naval Institute. The subtitle is The General Board and the Design of the Fleet that Defeated the Japanese Navy. He has another book out I'm sure we're going to discuss here in the immediate future. But for most of us in the Navy, the critical time period for the fleet that we have today was actually the period between World War I and World War II. And the innovation, as Dr. Kuhn said, was driven by the fact that there were some naval treaties in place, limited the number of capital ships. In those days, that meant a battleship and other types of vessels that could be developed. And that spurred a whole lot of innovation and rethinking of the possibilities of what could be done to continue to allow us to exert our presence in the Western Pacific in light of what the Japanese were up to. I don't know where Salamander's gone either. This is great. And for my next number, I'd like to sing Lady of Spain. Let me get my accordion out. No, Maggie, I'm not going to sing any sea shanties. because unless you like Bob Dylan singing sea shanties, that's about what you would get if I started singing.
Hey, well, how's your monologue going there, Eagle One?
Well, so far so good. Nobody's hung up on me.
Well, we got John back. And, John, I wanted to bring us back here to the center line before we had some battery problems. Is, you know, we were talking about grand and naval strategy and going back from the general board to now. And there's been a general critique about our strategic studies group in Deep Blue right now. And a lot of the critique towards them is that we've moved away from discussing strategy and policy and have really began to bore in simply on technology. I kind of derisively call this group of people the transformationalists. And they just really get focused on the technology almost independent of a grand strategy or policy going forward. Is that an accurate critique? And are there things that we really perhaps are off sync of right now?
Well, I don't know if accurate's the right word. I think it's a fair critique. Now, full disclosure, guys, the year after the book was published, the Strategic Studies Group had me in to talk to them about these issues. And I talked to them, and eventually the lecture became an article that I had published last year about my hand being dead. I wrote the article last year calling for another general board, and I said, hey, we don't need to go out and invent the wheel. We've got some smart guys in Newport called the Strategic Studies Group. The only problem is they're not doing strategic studies. They're focused, like you say, on really operational type stuff, and it's very heavy on technology. I don't want to betray the trust of Admiral Hogg, who kind of keeps me informed on these things. He's the kind of the head of the Strategic Studies Group. But I do want to say that right now the charter for those guys is too narrow, and I think they're an ideal forum, to be honest with you, because they're independent. They're not. I like the idea of them not really working for OPNAV. I like the fact that they've kind of gone back to doing what the Naval War College did before the general board. You know, of course, now we don't have a general board. They're kind of doing their thing at the Naval War College as kind of an independent group that kind of, do they work for the CNO? Well, kind of, sort of, but it's a real flat hierarchy. But I think they need to be more involved in policy. So I agree with you on that one. I think they need to be more at the policy level, and that we need that in the Navy. Right now, we're still stovepiping this. You know, let's go inside NAVC and do, you know, get the skib together again, you know, and so we'll get the design, we'll get coherence back in the design world. But, you know, the general board brought all that together. They brought the design and the policy worlds together, and they held hearings. And I really liked that hearing thing. And then they made transcripts of all the hearings, which is really great for guys like me, historians, and go back and read what the heck it was they said, you know, so that makes it even better.
Let me ask you a question about the through-deck cruiser. And as I understand it, this was a sort of designed. We never got built, but these were cruiser hulls with an aircraft carrier capability, but with a fewer number of aircraft than we'd currently have on a large deck carrier. Is there in the modern world? First, let's talk about what happened to that, and then in the modern world, is there a place now, as we look at diversifying our force, is there a place now for a similar concept of a through deck cruiser of sorts?
Well, yeah, I think you're talking about the flying deck cruiser, and you know the world's expert on this is Alan Zinn. I mean, he really knows about the flying deck cruiser. And the point I make in my book about the flying deck cruiser is that they come up with a very, very innovative design. The final design can hold about 40 airplanes. It's got catapults. But, again, they had catapults on ships anyway, but not the advanced catapults we have now. And Tom Holm and Norman Friedman and these guys have been talking about the development of the steam catapult. But they did have catapults. And the flying deck cruiser, actually, the final design had a bit of an angled deck, which they angled because they wanted to have the gun directors that could control the 6-inch guns that were going to be on this thing. So 6 or 8-inch, but they were going more and more towards rapid firing 6-inch guns. And Zim's point, and I make the same point, is that, well, it would be nice to think what might have happened had they actually built one of these things. The General Board had a lot of interesting ideas, and a lot of ships got built that people say, well, that was a Hogan's goat. That thing didn't work out very well. But they learned a lot because they experimented with all these things in the fleet, you know. And, again, I don't have a problem with LCS if you can learn your lessons from the design. If you don't learn the lessons, then that's a bad thing. Well, they learned lessons from the V-class submarines. They learned lessons when they built too small of a carrier, the Ranger. And with the flying deck cruiser, they never got a chance to learn any lessons. And they never got a chance to learn that the angled deck was a great design and that people would have discovered when they got it out in the fleet, hey, this is a cool thing. The other thing that the flying deck cruiser emphasized was that the Navy had real problems getting aviation into the fleet. They just couldn't get anything built. They couldn't get the big aircraft carriers built. So, you know, I make the argument that one of the reasons everybody wanted this thing, including Moffett. Moffett really kind of wrote the thing into the London Treaty as a way to cheat, to create basically light carriers and get them into the fleet. Because maybe Congress would build a cruiser if they wouldn't build a carrier. Everybody says, well, the Navy wasn't interested in aviation. There were battleship admirals, and they didn't like aviation, which is, that's a bunch of horse crap. I mean, the U.S. Navy was as air-minded a fleet as any. In fact, they were the most air-minded fleet of all the major navies. The United States Navy was far more air-minded, to be honest, more than the British, and believe it or not, more than the Japanese. And that might be hard to understand because the Japanese did Pearl Harbor. But if you study the Japanese in World War II, you quickly realize that the Japanese officer corps is far less air-minded than the U.S. Naval Officer Corps is. Well, let's talk about today. What is a hybrid design or something like this give this? Well, you know, the whole deal right now is what's going to happen to naval aviation. Well, I think as long as there's airspace over the sea, we're going to have naval aviation. Now, is it going to be manned or unmanned, some manned, some but I think there's a lot of room for figuring out how to do what we need to do on the global commons and with power projection for naval aviation. And maybe going with some different approaches here is the way to go. There's a piece of me, this is the old naval aviator in me, that doesn't like removing the man from the loop too much. You know, we've got a kind of sterile air warfare that we do now using robots and drones, Hellfires and Predators and everything, and we really haven't accomplished many operational objectives with that program. I mean, it still took a bunch of guys on a bunch of manned airframes to go sailing into Pakistan and kill bin Laden. That wasn't a bunch of drones, and that had a real operational impact. All these other things, I haven't seen many operational impacts to be honest. Well, when I say operational impact, I mean an operational result that led to strategic results, political results, at the political level of war, which we seem to have forgotten about, and that's where we get back to grand strategy. So I think there's a lot of room for innovation and experimentation in the Navy right now. And, you know, I don't think it's bad to maybe build a couple, to try something new and figure out how it works out and whether it meets the end. But I think we have to be clear about what our vision here is for these things. I think a program that does that is the Virginia class. I think the Virginia class is a program that's pretty well thought through, and that, yeah, maybe it's a little bit more expensive than we like, but it's a pretty well thought through program. Should we go entirely to submarines? Well, I don't think we're to that point yet where we go entirely to submarines, but submarines do have, because of nuclear reactors, they have staying power, but they don't have the visibility on the surface. And again, as long as there's airspace above the sea space, there's going to be a need for naval aviation or some type of maritime aviation. The Army never really put that as a high priority during the interwar period. They tried to get money by saying, well, we can defend the coasts, but they couldn't find anything. And even the Navy guys who practice finding things at sea had a hard time doing it. So once the Air Force got into the thing, they always had a hard time
finance stuff at sea, and that's one of the big myths today is how easy it is to locate people in the open seas. It ain't easy. And it's a great place for the United States to kind of hang out with military power because it is such a challenge to target ships at sea. Now, does that mean that we need, 24 aircraft carriers? No, People ask me, well, we're down to 9 aircraft carriers. And I go, of course, you're including the LHDs in that number, I hope, because an LHD in any other Navy is an aircraft carrier. But I get poo-pooed by the Marines when I talk about that. And I go, so there's no airplanes up on that flat deck? And they go, no. But there are. They belong to us. It's flying artillery. I'm like, oh, okay, right. Okay, yeah, that's what they do most of the time on most cruises, is they're flying artillery.
I think that's an exact point that a lot of people miss about the large deck Gator freighters that people will derisively have. They have a lot more uses. You made a comment earlier about the general board and the impact that it had on ship design that brought me back to one of my favorite pictures. If I could have a 4-foot by 8-foot poster of this, it might be stapled to the ceiling above my bed. But in Pearl Harbor in 1943, there's a picture of the USS Pensacola CA-24, USS Salt Lake City CA-25, and the USS New Orleans CA-32, all were commissioned between 29 and 34. And you can see how they did what you're just talking about. Build a little, experiment a little, improve a lot. And then I go back to, all that evolution took place in 6 years of ship design. I look back in the last decade, almost a lost decade, and look at LCS, DDG 1000, and LPD 17. And with all our technology, we really have lost something there in ship design, haven't we?
Well, yeah, the ship design guys out at Carter Rock would they if they're listening in, those guys, Keen and all those guys, they're probably jumping up and down and clapping their hands. We have, and part of the problem is because we've got this. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower was right about one thing: is that we've got this system in place that doesn't allow the kind of innovation that we. I mean, the Navy used to build some of their own prototypes. I mean, we had our own shipyards, the Naval Research Lab that was created to create weapons for the United States Navy. Now, did it have some failures and some very high-profile failures, and did the Navy have some weapon systems that they're sort of like, poster children for, this is the way not to do a classified weapon system? That would be the Mark 14 torpedo. Yeah, they had some of that, but they had a lot of very successful designs, too. We had the best sub of the war. The Gator-class submarines with their air conditioning were the best submarines of the war, ideally suited for long-range cruising, and ideally suited. But what do we have, for the past 10 to 15 years? Well, we don't have much. We have what we had, the Arleigh Burke, which was a huge design success, a wonderful program, but we're living on these beautiful designs that were created for the Cold War. Probably the best thing that we've done since the end of the Cold War, again, I would point to the Virginia class as being a pretty good program. And maybe the SSGNs, although the jury's still out on those babies. I'm not sure, but I don't like the idea of throwing away a huge submarine that's not yet at the end of her service life. There's something in me about that. But we're not doing that right now, and we're not doing a very good job of something I think the United States Navy needs is a frigate. I think we need a nice low-cost frigate. I think if you want to talk about doing or a seagoing mine vessel, not just a mine hunter or a mine sweeper, but a multi-mission mine vessel. LCS was supposed to be modular and do that kind of thing. But, I mean, we're losing all these various capabilities that we used to have. There's a great saying that Captain Wayne Hughes had, which was that every single ship in World War II except mine sweepers ended up doing a different mission than it was envisioned that she would do in the interwar period. Every last one ended up doing something completely different than they thought she was going to do in the next war, from battleships to carriers to destroyers to submarines. submarines, for example, were going to be advanced eyes and screening forces for the fleet to find the enemy battle fleet. Instead, they became commerce raiders for the United States. So, and that comes from Wayne Hughes. So attribution to Captain Hughes for that. So we need to always keep that in mind, too, that, you know, they're probably not going to get used for what you designed them for specifically, although that mission will probably be in there somewhere, but there's probably something that they're going to end up doing that you hadn't planned on them doing. Look at all these Cold War ships. Were they really all designed to do power projection? Nope. But did a lot of them end up on the gun line off Vietnam or power projecting in the Gulf or in the Med? Yeah, they sure did, didn't they?
Well, we got a couple of minutes left, John, and let me ask you what projects you've got coming up. And I know you want to talk just for a minute about your other book. Would you go ahead and do that?
Oh yeah, Eyewitness Pacific Theater. Now, if you see the little picture on the blog site there, the Dennis John Greco, who's my DM, John Greco is his pen name. He got me involved in the project. He's done a number of eyewitness books, and so he brought me into the project and. And that book is kind of a thinking man's coffee table book. It is the Pacific War through the eyes of the people who fought it. Now, when they had me do this, when Dennis roped me into this, they had a lot of interviews with Marines and Seabees. And I thought, well, the Pacific War included Army Air Force, the Marines, the Navy, and Army Ground Forces. So I went out and I took it as a special challenge to go out and find a lot of additional interviews. So there's some really great interviews. There's one interview in there that talks about Charles Lindbergh shooting down a Japanese Zero in the Pacific in 1944. Some of the pictures in there, I read one of the reviews said, oh, these are all the same old pictures. No, they're not. Some of those pictures have never been seen anywhere else before. But it's a really good book to give you a feel for World War II in the Pacific across the spectrum, the joint spectrum, both at sea, in the air, and on land. And it takes a look at a couple of theaters that you don't normally look at. I'm the one who organized all the interviews, edited all the interviews, and wrote the narrative. And most of the sidebars in the book are mine. And then Dennis is a design layout genius, so he did a lot of the captions and the patches and everything. But it's a really, really cool book. Great book. For somebody who doesn't have a lot of familiar with the Pacific War, it's a great book to kind of get your feet in there. And it also shows you just how vast the Pacific is. And I think if Americans are going to learn a little bit about the world, it's nice to see pictures of the rest of the world, and that book certainly has that. So that's a book. It came out the same year as Agents of Innovation. So actually I did two books in 1 year. That was my big year, 2008. I didn't do anything but write and stay up all night on the computer that year, but it was a fun year, and I got some sleep in 2009. John Greco, by the way, is another Naval Institute Press guy, so he had a book last year, Hell to Pay, which is about the war planning for the end of the war with Japan, and he makes a very, very powerful arguments about the plan to invade Japan and the kind of casualties we were going to take, and use a lot of original archival and documents that have been talked about that people don't normally